On the 28th of August of 2003, I was in my office and received information that the PNC Bank, which is located directly across here, had been robbed by an individual apparently wearing a collar bomb. Brian Wells walked into the PNC Bank with a cane and the collar around his neck. We later learned that the cane, it was actually a gun, a cane gun.
I don't have a lot of time, he said. Police wanted to talk to him, Brian Wells, about a bank robbery that he had pulled off, but he told them that he had been set up and that the bomb he was wearing would go off and soon. And then it did on live TV. But that was only the beginning of the mystery. It took 4 years, but police finally pieced together a plot that apparently Wells, the delivery man, was in on to an extent. Police say Wells was part of the bank robbery scheme, but that he didn't realize that he'd be wearing an actual bomb.
Hello and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler and writer-producer on CBS's Criminal Minds in season 14. And finally, today, we're all back together in the studio. Woo! And with me is...
Laura Richards, criminal behavioral analyst, former New Scotland Yard and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I'm Lisa Zambetti. I'm the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, and I have a real interest in real crime and these fantastic minds that solve those crimes. The amount of brain power in this room right now is overwhelming me. So nice to be here.
So we are continuing our coverage of Evil Genius, so who better to have with us as our special guest?
A genius in his own right, Jim Fitzgerald.
There you go.
And modest, too.
Fitzy J in the house with us via Skype.
How you doing, Fitz?
I'm doing great. Just finished watching a certain docuseries called Evil Genius, and I'm very much anxious to talk about it. I know you guys have talked about some of it already, so I'd be glad to give my two bits and of a fascinating case that I worked back in the day, at least to some degree, and it brought back some... Very vivid memories watching it on Netflix over the last week or so.
Yeah, right. Can I say real quick that I had no idea that you worked on this case, but when I saw what we're going to talk about, that 9-page tome, I thought, oh my God, if Jim Fitzgerald needed a birthday present, this would be it. Like handing you those pages and having you, you know, just dive into it and tear it apart. I can't wait to hear what you have to say about that. But
well, I'm holding the pages here in front of me now, and I remember a lot of the notes I took back in the day, and I don't have the original letter, if you will, but I certainly have the copy I made here, and it all came back to me, especially watching the TV show, of course.
Right. So, Fitz, tell us how you became involved in the case then.
I remember very well. It was late August of 2003, and I believe I was in the at the behavioral analysis unit in Quantico, Virginia. I mean, actually in the office on that day, and I heard something about a bizarre, you know, bank robbery in Erie, Pennsylvania, that they may need some help. And Jim Clemente knows this. In 2003, the BAU changed from its time-honored sort of geographical separation of our units, where most of us, there was a BAU East. We were east of the Mississippi, BAU West, of course, west of the river. And then we had all different regions within. And I was a Northeast U.S. region. I covered Pennsylvania. But right in around June or July of 03, as Jim will remember, we changed it from geographical areas, so to speak, to specialties. And we broke the BAU up into three separate units. One was child victimization. Jim was in that unit. Another was adult victimization, if you will. And I was in the threat assessment forensic linguistic unit. So I didn't technically get assigned this case when it first came in, the people in the adult profiling unit, so to speak, or victimization unit. And so I wasn't directly in contact with the agents up in Erie out of our Pittsburgh division until a few weeks later, when actually they came into the office, and in advance they sent this long tome with me, as you said, Lisa, and that's when I started getting to work on it.
Yeah, and just for the listeners' benefit, we should tell them that we were all cross-trained in all the different areas in the BAU, and we still consulted on cases with case agents that were in those specific units. but we had separated out specialties in the different units. And your specialty, forensic linguistics, obviously applied to almost any case across the board. So it was really good to have your input into this particular case.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And you're certainly right. We all were cross-trained, but we all kind of agreed that, you know, that there were certain specialties either we felt we were better in or it just made more sense to be in those particular three units. I think, Jim, right now they're up to five separate units. There's a, I think, a cyber element to it, and of course a terrorism element to it. We set the bar back in those days, though. And so while another agent from, I think it was BAU2, was actually running with everyday interaction with the agents in Erie, Pennsylvania, out of our Pittsburgh division, before too long, once this note became available, and quite frankly, Jim, as you and I shared time together on the New York City bank robbery squad, so bringing me into this also made a lot of sense, too. There was, of course, cross-interaction between these then three units, as I'm sure there is now with the five units, and I was glad to help out and lend my expertise, not only from a linguistic perspective, but certainly from my experience in working hundreds and hundreds of bank robberies back in my days in New York City.
Yeah, well, I was telling everybody that we actually had 2,000 bank robberies in our first year in the, on that bank robbery squad. It was a joint FBI NYPD task force. But yeah, in those cases, do you remember the series Bomb in a Bag? I got a bomb in the bag. Remember that?
I do remember that, but it turns out it never was a bomb.
Right, exactly. And that's what I was saying. Most of these cases where somebody threatened to have a bomb, there was no bomb at all. And in this particular case, not only was there a bomb, it was a bomb that worked and a bomb that exploded, killing the guy who was wearing it. So this is a very unique case in my experience. How about yours, Fitz?
Yeah, it's unlike any others. There's certainly been bomb threats before. There have been actual bombs before. People know I was involved in the Unabomb case, but that's a lot different than this one. We have up close and personal victimization of one individual, of course, that being Brian Wells. And then, of course, the whole tasking that he was given and his alleged role in it. So this is unlike anything. And I'm sort of a student of criminal justice history, not just in the U.S., but certainly around the world. And in all my travels, there ain't nothing like this anywhere that I've ever heard before. And I was glad to be a part of it in the early days, although it took us a while to put this whole puzzle together and finally resolve exactly what happened.
So why don't you just explain to our listeners, because you mentioned BAU2, and of course I came out and spent some time with you in the BAUs, but just to mention which units, you know, you were BAU1, weren't you, Fitz, and BAU2, just to explain to our listeners what that means.
Sure, and most of us realize when we were working geographic areas, I mean, one day we'd be assigned a threat case, the next day we'd be assigned, you know, maybe a missing kid, the next, it's a bank robbery, you know, a serial bank robber, of course, serial rapists, serial homicides. And we all were good at what we were doing, but a lot of us, just over 5 or 10 years there, this in 03, I was in my eighth year or so in the unit. Jim, you were probably like in about your, sixth year or so. And we just realized there were things, A, that we liked doing better, B, that we were, in fact, better at doing with our experience, education, whatever. And see, I was the only person, quite frankly, in the whole FBI that put myself back in school. And I was working on my second master's degree, and this one in linguistics at Georgetown. So I was kind of the guy from all over the bureau. They heard about this profiler who's also a linguist, and that was me. And whenever a case involving, you know, a school shooter or some letters found in a high school locker to terrorist manifestos, I mean, obviously the Unabomber's manifesto, I'd be the one they would turn to. So that was my unit, BAU1, Threat Assessment, Forensic Linguistics, anything to do with written or verbalized threats or communications that are part of a crime or whatever, that unit was involved in that. BA2 was basically your, if you watch the TV show Criminal Minds now, and I think there's a few people on this podcast that are involved in that, you know, that's kind of what that unit represents, is the traditional profiling unit, and they cover basically everything. They're jacks of all trades and masters of all of them, quite frankly. And that's what the BAU2 was, who wound up taking over this case once the request was made from the Pittsburgh division. And then BAU3, as Jim well knows, was formed out of the old CASCU, Child Abduction Serial Killer Unit. And that kind of went away, but then and it morphed into just geographical units. And then BAU-3 was formed, and those folks who volunteered and raised their hands, and Jim being one of the best among them, was there to work crimes involving the victimization of anyone 17 years of age or younger. It worked really well, and they've since expanded that model to adding in a separate, I believe, computer crimes unit and a separate anti-terrorism unit. And that's how they are set up today.
Well, thanks for that history lesson. And so can we get into this letter that you got? What exactly did you see when you saw that letter?
And this is the first part of your involvement, is looking at the letter, or did you do something else before this, in this case?
Lisa, it was basically, this was the first part of the letter. And also, and Jim, I'm sure this has happened to you, but I heard this in the unit. I probably went home later that day and I watched it on the news. And I said, you know what? I'm going to be involved in this case in the next few days, few weeks, whatever. It was, and there's been a few cases around the country, either from a geographical perspective or linguistic perspective, I knew I would somehow be involved in this. So it took us maybe into the following week, and maybe we're into September of 2003 now, and finally the letter, a copy of the letter is sent to us. The original letter went to the laboratory for all kinds of examinations there, and I don't think they really had too much luck with that in terms of fingerprints or DNA, anything in that regard. So I was charged with looking at this from a forensic linguistic perspective. I think I got it on a Wednesday. I said, I'm setting aside the rest of the week to figure this thing out. And none of us worked short days back then, Jim, as you recall. So a 9-hour day was usually a short day for us. And that included lunch at the desk. So yeah, I spread these papers out on a larger desk in a conference room. And I had my marker pens out and I went to work. You know, my profiling hat is on my head. My linguistic hat's on my head. But also my former bank robbery investigative hat was on my head. And I'm trying to put all of this together. And the first thing that came to me is, like some other cases we've worked in the past, is that there is so much effort put into this letter, so much time, and it's all basically unnecessary. And especially since they were asking for these grandiose amounts of ideally $250,000, $250,000. But, you know, the other plan was only $150,000. And it turns out Wells only got about, what, $8,100 that day in loose cash. So they really miscalculated this thing from the very beginning. And I said, whoever planned this, and I didn't know one person, two persons, this is very early on, is Wells involved in this? I didn't know that either. He seems like an innocent pizza man. Certainly that's how it's coming across in the beginning. But I said, who's ever put this thing together, certainly this letter and the activities themselves, they never did a bank robbery before in any way, shape, or form, even though they claimed they planned this for 7.5 years in prison. And that's obviously a contraindicator. We knew that wasn't true, because if you had that much time, you would have come up with a better plan than this that would have gotten you more money. So the first thing I knew was these were not professional bank robbers, not even professional, criminals in terms of attaining money for greed. They may have been doing other things in their lives, and we've since found that out. But this was a very time-consuming yet not very effective method of trying to rob a bank, not just the letter itself, of course, but even the utilization of the bizarre device put around the neck of Wells.
Just a quick question. In your bank robbing experience, do bank robbers usually come in and ask for a certain amount? I mean, don't they just give me everything? They don't, I mean, why 250? Why not 350? Why not,
right. It's ridiculous, actually. Yeah. I mean, it belies their ignorance on how you pull off a bank robbery. And just by looking at that letter in a gross fashion, I mean, the length of it alone, and as you said, the time it took to do it, and there's even been a theory that they actually typed it all out and then wrote over the typing to disguise their handwriting. And the fact is that, to me, just by looking at it in a gross way, it looks like the product of someone who is suffering from mania, somebody who can't contain themselves.
Well, was it coherent? I mean, it certainly seems overly complicated, to write 9 pages. But in terms of the rest of the content? Was it coherent in the way that it flowed?
Yeah, and that's a good question, Lauren. That's, as a forensic linguist, the first time I sit down with a letter or a note, whatever it is, email, blog posting, whatever it is, I always try to look at, you know, how, just how coherent is this? And does it, doesn't make sense? Is the person a native English speaker, first of all? Are there indicators of education or profession in there? Do we have indicators of gender, male, female? And these are all things I was trying to work through on this. And I remember after, I think that Friday afternoon of spending about, you know, 20 plus hours on this letter itself, I remember saying, boy, I think we have more than one person involved in the composition of this letter, not just the handwriting part of it. And I agreed, I think we agreed early on, Jim, someone probably typed this out and then just traced over top of it, because it almost looks like from a distance, some kind of a computer font that you could, you know, probably order up on Word somehow. And the size is the same and the underlinings, whatever. But the first clue, I think the very first page I had, it wasn't maybe the first page, but I believe it was the page to reception. And it about halfway through the page, the person says, person writes, "We will screen for dye packs." And they spell dye, D-I-E. And as we know, it should be D-Y-E. So right there, if these guys spent 7.5 years in prison and elsewhere, you know, discussing this, you'd think somehow they would know how to spell the word dye for what actually that would be. A device, of course, which blows up after a certain amount of time and it spreads paint all over the person carrying it. I've arrested people that those devices have gone off. So they were smart enough to ask to make sure the dye pack wasn't in there, but it was very clear to me they didn't spell it right, which made it even clearer to me that they didn't know what they were talking about when it comes to actually robbing a bank.
I mean, and the time it would take for the teller to sit there and, like, read this 9-page letter.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, it kind of flies in the face of the act that you're trying to, or your actual outcome, doesn't it? The longer that you're in.
And you're right, and about that, of course. And, of course, this was designed not just for one person. There was a letter to the bomb hostage, which is the term, of course, the authors and the masterminds behind this crime. There was a letter to the receptionist in the bank. There was a letter to the—I mean, it's all one letter Wells is carrying, but I mean, these are designated for these individual people. The bank manager had one. Of course, the police then had their own separate, I think, 2 or 3 pages assigned for them. And it's like this guy's putting out a small edited volume of documents on how to walk through a crime. But the problem is it had to be read by all these people and deciphered. And by the way, they misspelled decipher in this. Some of the few mistakes they made— but they, you know, numerous different people had to decipher this all within about 1 hour or so, if I have my time here correct. So just so much of it was just off the wall and just had no semblance of reality to it. It's like it was more of a game that was being played. And I know there's a scavenger hunt element to this, but that was just as important to these people than perhaps even attaining the $250,000, the $150,000, or even the 8,000 that it eventually turned out to be.
Yeah, so there was no way that he could ever have completed all of these tasks with the time ticking on that collar. And in fact, even if he'd gotten the keys, I think it was the bomb was wired in a way that it would have gone off anyway. Like there was no way to disarm it once it started.
Yeah, the thing was it was supposed to unlock the collar and then it'll blow up somewhere else. But so Fitz, do you think, based on the complexity of this letter and the other behavior in this, that the victim of this, that Brian Wells, was actually aware of and involved somehow in this entire plot? And that the people who actually were sort of the masterminds behind it, actually intended for him to die?
Oh, there's no doubt they knew this guy was going to die, and he was just collateral damage as far as they were concerned, and he was the local neighborhood sort of dupe that they just sort of, and I believe he was involved in this. He perhaps didn't think he was going to die, but nonetheless, that's, I think the people involved in this certainly knew that. And it would have to be a perfect storm of absolutely everything going right for him to even possibly have a chance to get the keys and the combination and everything else involved to free himself from this. So my from early on, upon reading this and learning the facts of the case from the agents and the task force that was assembled up in Erie, Pennsylvania, I was convinced this guy was meant to die. The question is, how much did he know, and when exactly did he know it? And a big clue about that too, Jim, is, you know, he finally gets stopped by the police, and one of the first things he says is, three black guys, you know, come up to me and made me do this. Well, there's no indication at all any African-Americans, black guys, whatever, were involved in this. So here he's actually lying, you know, to protect the people that were involved in this. So none of this makes sense, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of any validity to it, in terms of this guy not knowing what's going on. He was part of it, although he probably didn't think he was going to die. And that was the surprise that caught everybody a bit off guard, about an hour or so after he was apprehended.
It was a long process because it started out as an amazing event, and then it just got weirder and weirder. And every time something was released, police served a search warrant, or we found out a little bit more information. We started talking about some of these things. The cane gun was really loaded. Every single piece of fact that came out was stranger and stranger, and people just kept shaking their heads and said, how could this happen here? But when you learn the whole story, I mean, how could this happen anywhere?
The police officers weren't quite sure what they had, and once one of them slid open his shirt and saw that it was an actual device and it looked like a functioning device, they just backed off and hid behind their car. I mean, they did not do anything to protect him from the bomb that was strapped around his neck. And I thought they could have slid a bulletproof vest underneath the rectangular part that covered over his chest to help protect him from that blast. What do you think?
Jim, that's an excellent point. And I got to tell you, as a former uniform police officer in suburban Philly, I've arrested bank robbers and I've made car stops. And I really did have some level of empathy for those police officers. They didn't want this guy to die. But of course, they didn't want to die either. They didn't know if he was directly involved, indirectly involved, a complete innocent person. They didn't know for sure. They suspect that this may be a real IED and it's ready to go off at any time. But they didn't know that for sure and to what extent. I always look back and say, what would I have done in that situation? And I mean, for the officers to all be standing right around him, you know, wouldn't have necessarily made any sense. But I agree, they probably could have maybe taken off their own ballistic vest. Some of them carry extra ones in the trunk. Some of them have like shields that they even can put in the vest when they know they're going to possibly go up against some heavy duty armaments coming in their direction. So there is possibly something looking back they could have done. I don't want to be too critical of them on the scene because it's something that the police academy just doesn't train you for that. And even when the bomb squad showed up, I mean, their job now, bomb technicians, is not to, you know, defuse devices and pull the red wire off the black wire, whatever. I'm not even sure what they would have done if they could have showed up there. So a very difficult situation. And unfortunately, nonetheless, Wells lost his life.
Yeah. And it's a situation that is unfolding in real time, but obviously being televised as well, which, you know, is a real challenge. The family, the first that they're seeing is him being blown up on screen, which, you know, must have been incredibly traumatic for them, the sister seeing it on the news.
Mm. Sure, and I didn't see it live, but I think his death was in fact recorded live, and by the time I saw it later on in the media, of course they cut that exact part out. I did see the actual footage in Quantico, you know, a few weeks later when the agents came, and to their credit or to their dismay, I mean, the producers of Evil Genius actually showed the device actually going off and Wells being killed. And it was very tragic and very moving to even watch that happen. But it's just a complex series of puzzle pieces that led Wells to that very moment in time and place where he was going to lose his life. And I'm not sure at that point anybody could change it.
about that footage that we did see in the documentary, and I looked this up. So the filmmakers did actually they blurred out the footage that they had, and they didn't show him from certain angles because they wanted to show the severity of this public execution, but without the gratuitous graphicness. So there is much, much worse footage that they could have showed, and I'm sure that you've already seen that, you know, they didn't put in this documentary. I just wanted to clarify that.
And so that was good. Sorry. That was a good choice that they made, and I'm glad they did it because, again, I don't like when filmmakers exploit victims by showing gratuitous violence.
So Fitz, can we just go back to the letter again, just on that, the question of coherence, you know, of the flow of those 9 pages? I mean, I've not seen the letter, but in terms of, you know, how it's laid out, a beginning, middle and end, is there a flow to it in terms of the ordering of what they're demanding and requesting?
Well, because there are numerous letters written for numerous people, and not by name necessarily, but at least identified by position in life, whether chosen bank manager, receptionist, police, or maybe, you know, tricked into it, bomb hostage. Each page or 2 pages sort of has its own beginning, middle, and end. And it's like each one for each recipient, if you will, was written in its own separate time and space. And each one tells their own little short story of A, what, you know, what we've done here, B, what we want you to do here, and see if you don't cooperate, meaning eventually get us the money, this guy is going to die. Your bank's going to look awful in the media. Other people may die. We know where you live. We followed employees home. We follow, customers home. So there's a lot going on in this letter to try to convince the readers plural, actually, of the credibility of what's going on. But it's really not provable, even on just a second glance at it. They followed employees and customers home, but they never actually give any addresses or even an intersection where somebody may live. So that could be knocked out almost right away. But again, I'm not anybody who's reading this in real time within minutes of being it handed to them by Wells. Of course, they're not going to be second guessing all these issues, who's been followed and who's not. This isn't something they had the benefit of looking at for hours and hours, if not days or longer.
Could you tell the gender? Could you eventually tell the gender and if it was written by more than one person?
I felt the primary author was a male. There was just enough specificity and indicators up here of sort of women tend to write, and they mention names. They mention networking and sometimes emotive types of issues, and of course there are exceptions to that, but I didn't see that here. This was very matter-of-factly written, almost like somebody, if they didn't have an engineering degree, at least somebody that had some sort of a background or studied it. It's very much A, B, C, D, and E, and I see this more as someone with a business background, engineering background, which doesn't mean a woman couldn't have that, but there is very little other indicators of female authorship here. But this is not something I would have testified to in court. We really couldn't do that anyway in U.S. courts. But nonetheless, I said I think the predominant author of this is a male, but I can't rule out that a female wouldn't be involved somehow in helping to compose the communication itself. I also noticed, too, that a few of the letters that are written in lowercase lettering, and then a few of the other, and I know it's one letter, but they're addressed to different people. And other of the letters, I think, especially the ones to Wells, his rules, and, you know, bomb hostage or McDonald's at the top. It's all in uppercase font. And I know it's hand printed per se, but I'm wondering if that's suggestive of at least 2 different people right there. But it could also be how they typed out the letters to him, and then they switched over to lowercase font, more traditional font, for the rest of the communication.
Is that a familiar countermeasure to you guys, that you would hand write something that had been typed? I mean, have you ever heard of somebody doing that before?
No, I haven't.
No, and quite frankly, I to anyone out there who's a handwriting analyst or thinking of getting into it, those jobs are dying out because it's just not that many people actually handwrite anything anymore. This is one of the few cases I've ever come upon in which it's, even though it's, we think it's stenciled or it's, you know, copied off of a typewritten document, it's very rare to see that nowadays. So it's more about linguistic analysis, the content of the documents themselves, which of course was my focus at that point in time.
Okay, so tell us more about overall your impressions from this series of letters that totaled 9 pages.
Yeah, it was a very meticulous person whose lifestyle is probably reflective of how this was. First of all, the act itself, the crime itself was carried out, but certainly how all these instructions were laid out. This person probably talks the same way. He probably steps over himself when he's talking, or he goes back and corrects himself, even in a normal conversation with someone. And again, I was convinced that there was at least 2 people, if not more, not only involved in the case itself, the crime itself, but the device as we went along. This author is so particular in how they wrote on the receptionist page. Not only is the dollar amount written out numerically, $150,000, then little 00 after that underlined, which is very unusual. But right afterwards, they also write out the words themselves, 150,000. They do that right below it for 250,000. Very similarly done. And I told the investigators all along, any suspects you have, you come up with, please get me some known writings of theirs, emails, letters to somebody, you know, blog postings. This was 2003 and people were doing stuff like that on the internet. I said, there are so many distinctive and idiosyncratic features on these letters, including using equal signs before and after certain terms like bank manager, receptionist, using quotation marks, which, Jim, you remember working the DC sniper case just the year before. And the DC sniper would use quotation marks around certain words or terms for purposes of emphasis. And that's not what quotation marks are for, of course. So, and I'm not connecting these 2 cases at all, but for some reason, both these people had these idiosyncratic features that would have been very valuable if known writing was ever picked up by any of them.
And what about the age of the authors?
Yeah, I definitely saw this person being older, 40 or above, person or persons 40 or above. I didn't see any teenage or youthful, emoticons or memes or anything like that. Although there are drawings of stop signs, or I should say traffic signal signs. And there's even a drawing of a McDonald's sign, which I thought that was kind of odd, feeling they couldn't only describe in words where this rock was, where this next, you know, clue to the scavenger hunt was, but they also had to draw a picture of a McDonald's drive-in. I felt that was just going so above and beyond what is necessary. That is sometimes a clue when you have to be that specific in your writing. It's sometimes a clue that you don't think people are taking you serious. You don't think people understand you in the other parts of your life. And this, you know, 9-page tome here, to use Lisa's words, really is reflective of that, I think. And this person probably never saw himself as being very well accepted or understood by those around him. And I think when we started identifying some of the characters involved here, we picked up on that. On the top of one of the pages, I think this was to actually the bomb hostage. It's one of the first sentences he would have read if handed to him in that order. He's told, you are to go to the PNC Bank, and again, PNC is in quotation marks, not necessary, at Summit Town Center. And Laura will appreciate this because when I first read that, I noticed center is spelled C-E-N-T-R-E. And I focused on that right away, and I wanted to know from the investigators, is that the name of the sign on the shopping center, the shopping mall, or do we possibly have someone, a Brit or someone who learned their English, you know, a British English as opposed to American English? And they told me very early on that, no, the shopping center is actually the word center is spelled that way on the signs. And we've seen other places too. So
that tells you it's a local, right?
With someone who's seen the signage.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course. But Fitz, one other question. So did you see it with the writing and the drawings? Is it seen as a work of art? Like in terms of the way, because you mentioned that it could be somebody who feels misunderstood, but conversely, it could be someone who, you know, is an artist and is enjoying writing this letter.
Oh, I have no doubt they enjoyed writing this letter, and there's no doubt, at least they feel they have some basic artistic background, and quite frankly, they may, because the signs are relatively the symbols, I should say, are drawn out relatively well, representing either the McDonald's sign or the traffic signal sign coming up in terms of landmarks where this person's supposed to go. So yes, they prided themselves in that, and they wanted to show whoever was reading this, and they knew someday this letter would wind up in the hands of the law enforcement. They wanted to make sure that they could put everything out there and be totally understood. And you know what? This carries also to the bomb itself. Look how distinctive and unique the bomb was, with many extraneous pieces to it. It all ties in together.
Okay, well, that sounds like a great segue into our next section of this, our coverage of Evil Genius, the Netflix series. We have so much more to ask you, Fitz, about the letter and about the device and about all the behavior surrounding this case. I'm really interested in hearing your perspective on it, and we really appreciate you telling us thus far how much you have told us.
FBI believe that whoever built the collar is patient and secretive.
Brian Wells here, he was supposed to go on a scavenger hunt.
And he was supposed to go from point A to point B to point C, where the keys would be given him to release this bomb.
This made worldwide news.
The purpose of the pizza bomber plot? Money.
How could this happen? Who's the mastermind?
Police, what's your emergency?
There's a woman that you might want to question.
So, Fitz, before we go, do you have any recommendations in terms of reading or listening or watching for our listeners?
Well, as long as you ask, Jim, those of you who read my third book, A Journey to the Center of the Mind, book three, the first 10 FBI years, knows that there's about six chapters early on about when Jim, both you and I were assigned to the bank robbery squad in New York City, and I discuss in there, you know, at least a half a dozen different robbery scenes and robbery cases that I've worked involving banks and armored cars, whatever. And so to give anybody who's interested in Evil Genius, the Netflix series, any other background on more traditional bank robberies, you'll be able to juxtapose then this particular case involving Brian Wells and others to how more successful bank robbers actually ply their trade. So check it out.
Thank you. Ladies, do you have any recommendation?
So yeah, I'm going to recommend Safe, which is a BBC drama, and it is, I think, about six parts. There's lots of twists and turns, and it's the actor from the show Dexter, Michael C. Hall. And yeah, he kind of holds it together as a show and has his version of a British accent, who Lisa sounds like she's not particularly keen on his accent. In it, but it's very interesting seeing him, you know, in this. So yeah, watch it on Netflix. It's, you know, quite twisty and quite a lot of turns.
Yep. So I want to recommend season two of Marcella. That is also on Netflix with Anna Friel. It's a great, she wears a different coat this time, but still a great show. And if you haven't watched Killing Eve, have you guys watched Killing Eve yet? We have to cover Killing Eve. It's amazing.
So it's Sandra Oh.
Sandra Oh and Jodie Comer, I think, plays, it's not a spoiler alert, she plays a female serial killer, and it's amazing. And also, guys, if you want a good book to read for book club that's coming up, please get A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. We're going to be covering it on book club maybe end of July, August. So stay tuned for that on our Facebook page.
And The Woman in the Window, because that was one that we recommended.
Yes,
and it would be great to
window.
Book club
absolutely
cover that too.
And of course, while you're out there, you should watch Manhunt Unabomber on Netflix to see the story of how Jim Fitzgerald was key in bringing down the Unabomber, Ted Kaczynski, and as well, Laura and I were in the case of Kaylee Anthony. And I think you can catch that on
Oxygen. There's lots of
Oxygen.
I think the full
com?
Episodes are actually up on Oxygen now.
Great.
Yeah.
Lots to do, guys.
Yes. Until next time, signing off for Real Crime Profile.
If you like our podcasts, there are a few things you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotions and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go to Facebook and like our Facebook page, and you can also follow us on Twitter at Real Crime Profile without the E. And one last thing, please tell your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate all of our listeners.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineering by Mike Thal. Music is composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107. Or you can go to the website where there's a lot of information and advice that you can follow on www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic abuse, you can call the National Domestic Violence Helpline for free on 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter or counselling, you can call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, on 214 946 4357. You can also go to their website for further advice or support, www.genesisshelter.org. And there's the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.